Have you ever found a treasure in like a really unexpected place? Something small, maybe tucked away, that reveals surprising depth once you actually bother to look.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Imagine finding a hidden gem, right? A tiny book that, despite its size, packs a powerful punch, sort of a blink and you miss it kind of book that's often overlooked in our Bibles. The letter of Jude, just 25 verses long, is exactly that. Our sources say it's brimming with obscure allusions and fiery polemic. That's like a really passionate, sharp attack on false teachings.
Oh.
And it's all addressing what they call a murky situation, some kind of difficult, unclear problem in the early church.
It's described as revered but conveniently forgotten.
Exactly. Rarely studied, you don't find it in standard Sunday church readings. It's almost like, Bible publishers could start printing it and maybe few would even notice.
And that's precisely why our mission today in this deep dive is to uncover Jude's vital contributions. You know, contributions to our understanding of faith, accountability, community. We're going to try and show what Jude offers to, well, justify its inclusion in our canon. Now, it definitely presents some initial challenges. Its brevity, for one. It gives us a really narrow window into its context.
Just 25 verses, yeah.
Then there's its focus on judgment and condemnation, which, let's be honest, kind of cuts against the grain of some modern values like
Yeah.
tolerance and pluralism.
That's true. A bit uncomfortable, maybe.
And then you've got its often obscure references, Old Testament stories, sure, but also extra biblical text writing people knew back then. But that didn't make it into the final Bible.
Right, like outside the official list.
Exactly. And finally, it's had a bit of a checkered reception through church history. I mean, even someone like Martin Luther apparently doubted its value.
Okay, let's unpack this then. With all those challenges and knowing it's so easily overlooked, why is this ancient text sitting quietly there at the back of the New Testament so important for us today? What does this little letter actually bring to the table that makes it, essential?
Well, despite the challenges and the obscurity, Jude makes at least three, I think, vital contributions to how we understand Christian life and leadership.
Okay, three things.
First, Jude powerfully reinforces the idea that God's grace in Jesus Christ has a profound purpose. It's not just a free pass or blanket approval for whatever.
Right, not just get out of jail free.
Exactly.
Right.
Instead, it's given for our liberation from the passions and cravings of our old self and our transformation into a new self that will stand blameless in God's sight.
Wow.
So any other response to God's grace, any other use of it, Jude says, amounts to denying our only Master and Lord Jesus Christ. This really lines up with what John Wesley emphasized, you know, that God saves us not only from the penalty of sin, but also from the power of sin, so that we may indeed live in holiness.
So if I'm hearing you right, grace isn't just about what's forgiven, but about how we live and how we're, well, transformed. That's a powerful distinction.
Precisely. And second, Jude keeps us really aware of our accountability before God, especially the certainty of God's judgment.
Accountability.
Okay, and he links this directly to ministerial integrity, you know, the honesty and uprightness of spiritual leaders. It kind of forces that crucial question: are we in the business of religion to serve God's purposes for the people God has entrusted to us, or are we in it to serve our own interests?
And while the scandals that have rocked so many denominations and churches, causing such widespread shame, they're just a constant, painful reminder that these dangers are always present. It's not just some ancient problem, is it?
Absolutely not. It's ever present. And third, Jude reminds us of our accountability to one another, our responsibility toward one another to hold each other accountable.
Ooh, okay. That one feels challenging.
It really cuts against the grain, as a source puts it, especially in, say, 21st century Western churches, which often emphasize individual self-determination above everything else.
My life, my choice.
Right. Jude speaks a really countercultural word here. He kind of emboldens us to intervene to restore brothers and sisters when they stray.
Which is uncomfortable enough.
And maybe even more uncomfortably, it humbles us to listen when we are the object of such interventions.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because Jude is asking us to think deeply about grace, integrity, and community, even when it's, well, super uncomfortable. It definitely challenges our modern sensibilities.
It really does.
Now, moving on to another puzzle, the very first word of this letter, Judas, Jude, a slave of Jesus Christ and a brother of James. This is apparently hotly debated. Who is this Jude?
That's a great question because, yeah, Judas was a super common name back then. The New Testament mentions several guys named Judas.
Right. Not just Iscariot.
No, definitely not. But our source points to Judas, the half-brother of Jesus and the brother of James, as the most likely author.
Okay, why him specifically?
Well, the thinking is you only identify yourself by mentioning a prominent brother if that brother was, you know, really well-known and respected in your circles.
And James, Jesus's half-brother, was certainly prominent in the early church, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He was huge. James seems like he wasn't really fully on board with Jesus' followers until after the resurrection.
Right, Paul mentions that.
Yes, but then he quickly emerged as a leader in the Jerusalem church. We see him playing a big role when Paul visits Jerusalem in Galatians, then at the big Jerusalem conference in Acts 15, he kind of gives the final verdict there.
Mm.
And again, in Acts 21, he's giving Paul instructions. So yeah, a major figure.
Okay. But despite this clear identification, you said scholars have debated whether this Jude actually wrote it, basically since the 19th century. So what are the main arguments against him writing it? And, you know, how do we understand those critiques?
Right. Well, critics often suggest the letter shows signs of being written later, maybe late 1st, early 2nd century.
Why later?
Well, a few things. Some argue the level of Greek used seems a bit too sophisticated for, say, a Galilean craftsman's son.
Okay.
Or that certain phrases, like the faith, sound like they refer to a fixed body of doctrines, which they argue is a later development.
Uh-huh. Like a creed or something.
Kind of. They also point to things that might suggest a waning expectation of Christ's return, or maybe an appeal to church hierarchy, neither of which they say fits the very earliest church.
Okay, those sound like pretty significant hurdles. How do scholars who support Jude's authorship respond to those points?
Well, when you dig a bit deeper, these arguments are actually quite defensible. First, the Greek thing. We actually have no direct knowledge of Jude's own craft.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he wasn't a craftsman like his father Joseph.
Oh, okay.
And he could have had lots of experiences, like living in multilingual Jerusalem, encountering Greek-speaking Jews from all over. Plus, other sources talk about Jesus' relatives being missionaries.
Where they'd need Greek.
Exactly. Where Greek would be essential. And besides, it's also really probable that Jude, like other biblical writers, would avail himself of the help of other Christians who were maybe more fluent in Greek. Especially if he's writing to Greek-speaking converts.
Makes sense, like using an editor or assistant, sort of. And the letter itself, it shows a wide Greek vocabulary, yeah, but not necessarily exceptional Greek style. And vocabulary is generally easier to pick up than complex grammar.
Okay, so the Greek isn't necessarily a deal breaker. What about the other points? Like the expectation of Christ's return.
Right. The waning expectation argument doesn't really fit Jude. He actually exhibits a lively expectation, or at least an expectation of God stepping in decisively to judge the world. It doesn't sound like someone dealing with a long delay, like you see in, say, To Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And as for appeals to church hierarchy, Jude has no such appeals. Not even any mention of church offices like bishops or deacons, which you do see in later writings.
Interesting. And what about the faith meaning a set body of doctrine? Is that definitely a later idea?
Well, that's a problematic criterion, too, because using the faith to mean the core convictions and way of life seems to appear very early in the church.
Yeah, Paul himself, writing probably around 40 AD, remembers Judean Christians talking about him preaching the faith he once tried to destroy. And Paul uses the faith that way in Philippians, too.
Ah.
So using faith to mean the content of the gospel message was perfectly normal in any period, especially when you're defending the gospel, which is exactly what Jude is doing.
Okay, so those arguments against his authorship maybe don't hold up as strongly as they first seem. Are there any positive signs that Jude did actually write this?
Yes, definitely. There are strong positive indications in the letter's deep rootedness in Palestinian Jewish traditions.
Like what?
Well, for example, the biblical phrases he uses often seem to reflect the Hebrew text of the Old Testament more closely than the Septuagint. That's the common Greek translation everyone was using.
Interesting detail.
Yeah. And he makes really expensive, dramatic use of 1st Enoch. That was a super important extra biblical text composed and most widely read in Palestine. It was even considered an authoritative text by the Qumran community, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls people.
Wow. Okay. So he's drawing on very specific Jewish sources.
Exactly. And he also seems acquainted with extra biblical traditions about figures like Cain, stuff you find in Palestinian texts like the Aramaic Targumim, those ancient Aramaic paraphrases of the Hebrew Bible. All these little details tie him strongly to that Palestinian Jewish world.
Okay. And what about dating it?
Well, there are no clear internal indications for a precise date. But considering the prominence of James, his brother, and just the likely lifespan of a younger brother of Jesus, it probably fits any time between about 50 and 80 AD.
And the fact he doesn't mention the temple in Jerusalem being destroyed, does that help?
Not really. It's not that useful for dating a letter the length of a postcard, as the source says.
Yeah.
He might just not have had a reason to bring it up.
Right. So putting it together, Jude calling himself a slave of Jesus Christ isn't demeaning. It's actually an honorific title, like Moses or Paul used, signaling authority. And his modesty in just calling himself brother of James points to his humility, but also connects him to this really key leader in the early church. It paints a picture of someone deeply rooted in that earliest community.
Exactly. The traditional authorship is actually quite defensible, I think. And that roots the letter firmly in the earliest days of Christianity, which gives its urgent message even more weight for us today.
Okay, so what about the people Jude was writing to? What can we figure out about them? And what was the problem that prompted this really urgent letter?
Yeah, Jude tells us very little about his audience directly. No specific location, no direct info on their ethnicity. However, the letter definitely assumes familiarity with Jewish traditions about Cain, fallen angels, Moses, stuff not in the standard scriptures.
Yeah.
And it assumes respect for First Enoch.
Okay, so that points towards...
It suggests a largely Greek-speaking Jewish Christian audience, maybe with some Gentile converts who would, you know, embrace these traditions along the way.
And where might they have been?
Well, an audience in Palestine would also accord well with the sphere of influence and oversight exercised by the relatives of Jesus, like James and Jude.
Makes sense.
And the specific problem Jude addresses, this relaxation of moral standards, that kind of thing would likely pop up in urban centers, maybe in Galilee or the coastal plains. Places where Christians were living right alongside and maybe coming out of Greek and other non-Jewish lifestyles.
Right. More temptations, maybe?
Perhaps. Places where things like Greek symposia, you know, those social gatherings with feasting and drinking and a generally freer indulgence, might tempt Christians, even at their own communal meals, their agape meals, or love feasts.
Ah, okay. And that would also explain why Jude wrote in Greek, right? To reach that audience.
Precisely.
And I noticed Jude uses such specific language to address them. They're summoned, beloved in God the Father, kept in Jesus Christ. It sounds like language once used for Israel.
It is. It sets this tone of goodwill assurance. Jude clearly feels affection for them, which is a really stark contrast to how he talks about the teachers he's warning them about.
Yeah, let's talk about them, these intruding teachers. What was their deal?
Well, they were clearly teachers from outside, a particular congregation or group of churches.
Yeah.
Jude says they wormed their way in, sneaked in, basically.
Okay. And what were they teaching or doing?
Their errors, Jude says, stem from their dreaming, which probably suggests some kind of ecstasy-based revelation, claims of having direct contact with the divine, maybe like some spiritual gurus you'd find in the Greco-Roman world.
Mm-hmm.
And the image he uses of shepherding implies they definitely presented themselves as spiritual leaders.
So was this a big theological debate? Like, were they arguing about who Christ was, the kind of Gnostic controversies we hear about sometimes?
No, crucially, these were not Gnostics. There's no real evidence of a Christological controversy here. When Jude says they were denying our only master and Lord Jesus Christ.
Yeah, verse 4.
It's more likely a reflection of these teachers' lack of interest in obeying Jesus.
Ah, so they still call themselves Christians. They were even at the church meals.
Yes, exactly. They were still part of the community, attending the love feasts. Their principal failure, according to Jude, was their refusal to align themselves with God's purposes for the grace, the favor God had shown them.
Okay, how?
They were transforming the grace of our God into shameless self-indulgence. Basically, treating God's grace as a license for self-indulgence. Anything goes because we're forgiven.
Wow. That's a problem we definitely see popping up in other New Testament letters too, isn't it? I mean, Paul had to correct similar stuff like sexual license in Corinth or people participating in feasts at idol temples.
Absolutely. Some teachers even seem to promote participating in idolatry for social reasons.
Yeah.
And Paul himself was apparently accused of promoting such self-indulgence by his opponents.
So Jude saw these guys as dangerous.
Oh, extremely. He basically says they were no better than the many other windbags peddling their philosophies or religions in the marketplace, just seeking a means of profit.
Ouch, windbags.
Yeah. He calls them charismatic sponges looking for a free ride. There's even a parallel in a pagan writer of the time, Lucian, who described a notorious charlatan named Peregrinus in similar terms.
So just using religion for personal gain.
That seems to be Jude's charge, and that's why he uses such strong language. He calls them ungodly, marked out long ago for this condemnation. He uses all those historical examples. Cain, Balaam, Korah, the rebel angels, Sodom, the Exodus generation.
Right, all those cautionary tales.
To show that people who behave like this, well, they come to a bad end. And he says this also fulfills the apostles' own predictions that such people would emerge within the church.
Okay, so what does all this mean for us today then? How did the early church, and how do we now figure out who to listen to, especially when there are so many voices claiming authority and truth?
Well, the situation Jude is addressing, it reflects this wider context in the early church, this resurgence of prophecy. There was a real sense of a fresh outpouring of the Spirit, right? With all sorts of charismatic gifts, speaking in tongues, prophecy.
We see that all through Acts and Paul's letters.
Exactly. Acts, yeah. Galatians 3, 1 Corinthians 2, Hebrews 2. It's everywhere. But because of this outpouring, it became really, really important to test what was spoken in the Spirit, to make sure it was actually from God. Paul himself said, "Do not despise prophecies, but test everything. Hold fast to what is good."
Okay, so how did they test them? What were the fruits Jesus warned about? How did they tell the difference between genuine spiritual guidance and something, well, harmful or just self-serving?
Well, they had several ways. Jesus's warning was fundamental. Beware of false prophets. You will recognize them by their fruits, which meant looking at the practical results of these prophets' work in the community. Did it build people up or tear them down?
Okay, so character and impact.
Yes. And Paul warned that just boasting of having had visions of angels or even living an austere lifestyle wasn't enough. That could be faked. For Paul, genuine authority came only from a teacher's connection with Christ.
Mm-hmm. A real relationship.
Right. And then the author of 1 John, writing after a church split, offered both ethical and doctrinal tests. Did they acknowledge Jesus was the Christ incarnate? And did they show a sincere love of the brothers and sisters? If not, they weren't moved by God's Spirit.
So belief and behavior.
Both. And then there were even practical guidelines. I think you mentioned reading about something like that.
Yeah, something about handling itinerant prophets, like a church manual.
That's right. An early Christian manual called the Didache, probably early second century. It actually devoted whole chapters to welcoming, supporting, and testing itinerant prophets.
Really? What did it say?
Well, they were supposed to be given respect, but they were to be booted out if they asked for money while claiming to speak in the Spirit, or if they stayed longer than it was reasonable, like more than 3 days sustenance. The message was clear. Spiritual gifts were not to become permanent meal tickets. You couldn't just live off the church indefinitely by claiming special insight.
So in many ways, the letter of Jude is one more really powerful window into this whole ongoing challenge, helping the early church, and maybe us too, discern the reliable teacher from one who will lead them astray from the faith once for all passed down to the saints.
Exactly.
It's such a powerful, if brief, message. Still resonates today, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Jude's letter, yeah, often overlooked, but it forces us to confront these uncomfortable truths about integrity, about accountability. And what's fascinating, I think, is that while the specifics of the ancient church's struggles might feel distant sometimes, the fundamental challenge, distinguishing authentic spiritual guidance from self-serving rhetoric, that remains just as relevant today as it was back then. It makes you wonder, how do you apply these ancient principles of discernment in a world just brimming with influencers and gurus of all kinds, constantly vying for your attention and your loyalty?
Wow. That's a really thought-provoking question to leave us with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the surprising and surprisingly relevant world of Jude.
My pleasure.
And for all of you listening, until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep digging for those unexpected treasures.